This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, welcome. In our second interview, scientist and author Naomi Oreskes takes us into the future when Trump wins and we all do nothing about climate change. She calls it the track to extinction. But first, let's learn how to deal with all this. Are you worried about our complicated society that it could break down? What can we do? And how much can we allow ourselves to feel about the terrible news that comes in every day? Carolyn Baker is a one-woman whirlwind of communication. She's up to date on the news of the world as she publishes her Daily News Digest. Carolyn is author or co-author of at least 11 books that I know about. Her motto is Speaking Truth to Power. From Boulder, Colorado, Carolyn Baker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks, Alex. It's great to be back. I really appreciate you having me.
Well, you know as well as I that a third of the great coral reef in Australia has died, the Arctic continues to melt, the atmosphere is clogging up with carbon. With all that, most people are fixated with the most popular soap opera on TV, and I'm talking about the Donald Trump show. Is that what you're experiencing as you try to get other news through to people?
Yes, absolutely it is. The clown show here in the United States is pervasive, and what is not being talked about are the kinds of things that you just mentioned. I mean, who knew that the coral reef was, you know, all of that news about the barrier reef is happening. If you turn on mainstream news today on television, you certainly would not hear that. So you have to look a little bit lower in the newspaper, below the fold on the seventh page, to see that kind of news. And that's terribly distressing because, as you know, we are on a fast track toward extinction of many, many species, including our own. That's where we stand right now, and people really are wanting to, they're wanting to learn more, I'm finding out, about living resiliently in these times, and that's what my work is about.
You know, a whole lot of people around the world are anxiously awaiting Donald Trump's downfall. But looking at Mike Pence inheriting that throne in the White House, maybe we should be hoping that Donald survives.
Well, I know I don't know about that. It's really Tweedledee and Tweedledummer in terms of the list, going down the list of people who would be a successor. And if Pence is found out to be as dirty as he seems to be, you know, then the next person in line would be Paul Ryan. That's a fate worse than death. So I don't see this as, oh boy, if we get Pence, that'll be better, or oh boy, if we get somebody else, that'll be better. This clown show is about the collapse of industrial civilization, and Trump is just speeding that up and making it more severe and throwing us a real curveball that we were not anticipating in this whole process of collapse.
I want to stick with Pence for a minute, though, because I just read an article by Glenn Greenwald in The Intercept laying out the fundamentalist Christianity represented by Mike Pence. Pence has been funded by the mercenary Eric Prince and the DeVos family, inheritors of the Amway fortune. And these billionaire uber-Christians pay out millions for anti-gay campaigns, for anti-abortion laws and anti-climate things throughout the country. Pence America would be pretty harsh.
Yeah, it actually would be. You know, rather than the hot-blooded fascism that we see in Trump, we would get this cold theocratic fascism that is extremely anti-women, anti-LGBT. And I'm very familiar with the whole Pence vibe, having grown up in Indiana myself and seeing what he's done there. So, the fact that him becoming president is a terrifying prospect. And I just think we're in a situation right now where there's so much that we don't know. We don't know who's going to succeed Trump, and we don't know what his impeachment is going to look like. I've been saying for many, many months that by the end of this year, impeachment hearings will be well underway, and possibly next year at this time, we will have a new president. And I'm not sure what all that's going to look like because Pence is very much implicated in this corruption as well. So we're at a place that I continue to talk about and I think is one of the most important points that we can understand right now, a place of uncertainty, a place of I don't know. And I'm really looking through the lens of I don't know on just about every issue. in terms of near-term human extinction, you know, the people that say, it's going to be by this time, it's going to be by that time. Well, it's going to be, but we don't know when, because there's so much about that we don't know. Just like we don't know the outcome of the debacle right now that is called the United States of America. So we have to, and this is why the work of learning how to live resiliently is so important, because we just don't know so many things that we have to become very used to now, living day by day, moment to moment, not knowing.
Well, I've had some experience in my family with a couple of extreme Christians, and I found that even though they were gentle people and actually loving people, they could accept almost any horror as part of the end times and the hope for return for Jesus. I mean, you know, global warming will wipe out the species, no problem. It seems so heartless and irresponsible coming from some good people. I don't understand it.
Well, you understand it by understanding the shadow. I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Dark Gold, The Human Shadow in the Global Crisis, in which I talk about the personal shadow that we all have and the collective shadow that every country and community has. And so these people walking around who are nice folks are carrying an enormous black bag behind them in which they have stuffed everything that they say is not me. I'm not a dishonest person. I'm not an unkind person. I'm not this, I'm not that. Because that, whatever that is, doesn't comport with my ego image of myself. So I say it's not me, I send it away. But in fact, when we deny it and then we project it out on other people, that shadow comes back to bite us. And that's really kind of what we're looking at right now. I think with the whole election of the Trump crowd, it is a reflection of our collective American shadow. It is no surprise to me whatsoever. And so it's very scary to think about these nice Christian people being in power. I grew up with all of that, so I know a little bit about it.
I want to talk to you a lot more about the shadow, because I think it's a key thing to what's going on right now. But, you know, my own program is based mainly on science, and it's possible some of my listeners feel uncomfortable talking about spirituality, but you talk about spirituality. How is that different? How do these things, science and spirituality, relate?
Well, I think science and spirituality are natural partners. It's only from the Enlightenment perspective that they are different, and, you know, that's the old news of 300-400 years ago, and Rene Descartes, and humans don't have souls, and animals don't feel anything, and all of that. And so quantum physics has really, in the last 100 years, brought mystery and science together. And of course, Einstein was really the driver of that. I think that there's a great deal of compatibility between science and spirituality, not science and religion, but science and spirituality, science and mystery, they're really kind of twin sisters.
Is the shadow, Carolyn, always a collection of negative things? I mean, if we're already acting out some of our worst as a society, maybe there's an inversion where our undiscovered selves might contain the brighter things, some of our lost good.
I think that's a possibility, because the shadow can be bright, as Carl Jung called it, or it can be very dark. For example, on a personal level, we all know many, many males who were raised in a macho context where don't cry, you know, man up, keep a stiff upper lip, don't show your emotions, and so on. Well, you can show anger, but don't show that you're ever fearful or that you're ever feeling any sadness or grief. And that becomes part of their shadow. The sadness, the grief, that's sent away. But there are times when that might come to the surface, and a man might show his grief, or he might show his fear. And, you know, that's the bright shadow. That's the part of him that he had to send away in order to survive, but could be a wonderful ally if he can do some shadow healing and allow that part to become part of his psyche and his expression in the world.
Well, we have some college stations that broadcast Radio EcoShock, and I'm concerned that some of our younger listeners may not have heard of Carl Jung, because he's a figure from a previous century. Who was Carl Jung?
Carl Jung was a brilliant Swiss psychiatrist living in, well, I think he passed in the 1960s. He was a student of Freud, and very much Jung was a scientist. But they parted company, and back to the question of science and spirituality, they kind of parted company over that issue because Freud was all about science and all about reason, and he could not in any way open up to the possibility of the spiritual aspect of the psyche, the soul, as Jung talked about. And soul just means psyche. It's not a religious term. And so they parted company, which was very, very difficult for Jung. And he almost had an emotional breakdown over that split. But Jung went off and began to integrate spirituality with psychology and gave us a phenomenal body of work, Jungian psychology, which isn't so much about becoming functional people in the world as it is about becoming whole people, connected with ourselves, connected with each other, connected with Earth.
Carolyn Baker, what is your own background in psychology and psychotherapy?
Well, it's very much a Jungian background. I was a psychotherapist in private practice for 17 years. I'm no longer a psychotherapist. Then I went into the classroom to teach psychology and history. But I had to do my own deep inner work, which certainly prepared me for the times that we're in now. And I continue to do deep inner work in other ways besides sitting in a therapist's office. And I'm very, very grateful for the background that I had that has really prepared me for the work that I'm doing today.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is author, life coach, and publisher of the Daily News Digest, Carolyn Baker. Carolyn, part of the story of the past generation was the determination shown by Britain during World War II. It looked hopeless. It looked like the Nazis might win, but they survived. From that comes the assumption that great challenges will bring out the best in humans. But perhaps climate change and our attempt to dominate the planet have done the opposite. They brought out the worst. Maybe this is not a fairy tale with a Disney ending. What if we steer right into a disaster beyond our imaginations?
Well, I think that's exactly where we're headed. And I'm not going to put a date on extinction, but I really believe that we are headed in that direction. You know, it is impossible these days to have a scientific conversation about climate change without the E word coming up. And so I am not optimistic about what we're doing to the planet. And what we were doing to the planet was already horrifying. And then you add to it this massive campaign of denial that we now see with the Trump clown show and the hostility towards science. And I think that might have exponentially set us on that trajectory even more than we already were. This is a time when we have to really understand where we are likely headed and learn what resilience is. The way I define resilience is the life-giving ability to shift from a reaction of denial or despair to learning, growing, and thriving in the midst of challenge. And so that's not about a happy ending, or that's not about, you know, well, I just think these nice positive thoughts and I'm going to feel better. This is about doing some deep inner work alongside trusted allies and people in community and connection. As we all walk in these two worlds, every person I talk with in coaching is telling me, I feel crazy. I feel like I'm in two worlds. I'm living with what I know to be true, and there's nowhere I can really talk about it. And when I go out into that other world where I can't talk about it, I feel crazy. And so that's part of what my work is about, and a new pilot course that I'm launching with my colleague Dean Walker this fall, one pilot course in Ashland, Oregon in September, another here in Boulder, Colorado in October, and it's called Resilience Bridge, Real Tools for Real Times. And we're going to be talking about things like how do we live resiliently in this time of incredible uncertainty. You know, the work that we're doing right now and that I'm continuing to focus on is providing a safe container for people in which they can explore these topics, a clear understanding of how we arrived at this predicament, and a deeper understanding of our individual and cultural shadow, but most of all, providing people with tools and practices to help them on a daily basis to cope with the uncertainty and the semi-certainty that we're headed in the direction of extinction.
Now, I hadn't heard of Dean Walker. Who is he?
Dean Walker lives in Ashland, Oregon, and he is the author of a forthcoming book called The Impossible Conversation, Choosing Reconnection in the Face of Business as Usual, at the End of Business as Usual. That's the title of his book. But The Impossible Conversation is the title that you want to remember. And you can look that up very soon. I think you'll see it on Amazon. And he talks, among other things, about why we cannot talk about climate change, why we just can't go there. And his emphasis, and my emphasis as well, is on we got here because we disconnected from our deep inner wisdom, which you might say is the sacred self. We disconnected from each other with this delusion of separation from everyone and everything, and we disconnected from Earth. And our work right now and how we build resilience is reconnecting in those three ways. I don't see anything else out there that is like the work that we're doing, so I really encourage people to check out this work. And go to my website, carolynbaker.net, and right there on the homepage, you're going to see our workshop, Resilience Bridge, and check it out and read through it and see if that grabs you.
Well, I looked at your website and I found a video that interested me. It was called Life Coach and Author Carolyn Baker Tosses a Lifeline to Depressed Collapsitarians, published March 11th, 2017. Are some people getting depressed because the economy and social system have not collapsed as fast as they thought it would?
Absolutely, people are getting depressed over that. I mean, I've known people who have been suicidal over that. And not just collapsitarians, but of course, the society at large, we're seeing a huge spike in the United States in, I don't know about Canada, but certainly here in the U.S., huge spike in suicides. And then we have this massive opioid epidemic among basically Trump's base and people who've been disenfranchised, dispossessed. You know, they might be 50 years old and they've lost a job and there's no sign of employment for them in sight. And all of these dreams and hopes, you know, have been dashed. There's tremendous despair right now, whether you're a collapsitarian or whether you don't know anything about that word collapse. You know, one of the things that we're teaching people in our work is how to embrace these feelings of fear, anger, grief, and despair, and become really a different person as a result of embracing them, becoming more resilient and being able to live in your heart and come from your heart and befriend what we call the dark emotions.
I remember in the hippie days, there was kind of an expression, life is what happens to you while you're expecting something else. And along those lines, for years, you and Michael Rupert reported on the big changes coming due to peak oil. Is the peak oil movement dead?
I don't think it's dead, and I'm not exactly sure where it is right now. Here's what I'm looking at more recently these days in terms of that. You know, there's this saying that you sometimes see on Facebook, and I think it came from George Carlin, America is an oil company with an army. And I think that we are seeing this in high definition with this current administration. I do believe that there is a there in terms of their relationship with Russia. It's way bigger than some 2016 election. And I think it boils down to oil. Rexxon Tillerson, who is now the Secretary of State, can't imagine you would have Rexxon in there unless your whole reason for having a government is to make oil deals. And so I think we're going to get with these investigations ultimately to the bottom of that rabbit hole. I certainly hope so. There's this frantic desire to make oil deals, which tells me that the peak oil movement isn't dead and that something more subtle than we mostly know about in the news is going on. Ugo Bardi, who writes for resilience.org, I think has one of the best perceptions of the oil predicament. And I encourage people to check out Ugo, U-G-O, Bardi, B-A-R-D-I, and his work.
I don't want to let us get away with it, though. I mean, I'm still driving around. I don't have an electric car. There's no place to plug in electric car here. And so I know that oils like heroin and people like Rex Tillerson and the Koch brothers, they're our dealers. Would you agree? I mean, we're all part of this.
Oh, absolutely. We're all complicit. There's absolutely no question. And that's part of the grief that I think we all have to come to terms with is our part in this. The fossil fuel industry, you know, reigns supreme, and we're all addicted to it in many different ways. I don't want them to get away with anything either. And anything that we feel we can do to simplify, to downsize, to live more in harmony with Earth, I certainly support that. It's not going to change where we're headed, but it can certainly make a difference in our own little world.
Carolyn Baker, you've been active in localization and resilience in Colorado. What's going on there these days?
Well, I'm very happy to say that my dear friend Michael Brownlee has created a free online webinar, which is going to start in mid-June. And I would like everyone to go to his website, localfoodshift.org, and read about this webinar and jump on with us in the month of June. I'm one of the presenters. There are going to be some amazing presenters, Richard Heidenberg and some rock stars from the permaculture movement. I mean, it's free. You know, what more can you want? Localfoodshift.org, Michael Brownlee.
Sounds great. I will check it out. Do you think the legalization of marijuana in Colorado has helped stimulate the counterculture there?
We have a pretty good employment scene here, much less unemployment than people are experiencing in other states. But I wouldn't say that there is a huge countercultural movement in this state. What there is, of course, is a huge fracking movement. And just as the fracksters in Oklahoma have created, you know, a plethora of earthquakes, we're starting to see now lots of leaks and lethal explosions here in Colorado as a result of fracking and uncapped wells that have been around for a very long time. It's not a pretty picture. This economy in the state has been very much based on extraction for decades.
Yeah, I can't believe, you know, I've seen pictures of fracking operations right beside schoolyards, right in amongst suburban houses.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Yes.
This toxic operation becomes part of children's lives. Now, you've had your own adventures with radio and podcasting. Tell us about the old Lifeboat Hour and the new Lifeboat Hour.
Yeah, when Mike Rupert took his life, he left a note to some of his friends, and, you know, I was one of those friends, and he asked me to take over the Lifeboat Hour, which I did in 2014, the week after his passing. And we ran that on Progressive Radio Network for a couple of years, which is the network that it was originally on. And then we just had so many technical issues, and it just was much more advantageous for me to create my own podcast. So I do have my own podcast, which you can hear every week, and it automatically comes to my website, carolynbaker.net. And I am pleased to have had a host of wonderful, wonderful guests over these last 3 years. We've gone now to every other week because it's just really hard to keep up with the once a week.
This is Radio EcoShock from Boulder, Colorado. We are talking with Carolyn Baker from the original Speaking Truth to Power site, carolynbaker.net. I want to return to this critical idea of the shadow, and there's some kind of an idea of a group shadow as well. Do you think that there is one, and has that been studied by academics or psychoanalysts?
Yes, I write about this extensively in my book, Dark Gold, The Human Shadow in the Global Crisis, and I talk about the personal shadow and the collective shadow. Jung certainly studied it, and some of his protégés studied it as well. I can't point you to any scientific studies that prove there is a collective shadow. I think by deduction, we can figure out that what infects the individual psyche or what is deeply troubling in the individual psyche is, of course, going to be mirrored in the collective and is going to be spread around in the collective. It just, you know, that just makes all kind of sense. Yeah, there are some specific shadows in our American history that we have not dealt with. and I talk about these in the book. Certainly, we have never dealt with the genocide of millions of Native peoples on this continent when we came here. We have never dealt with slavery. We have never dealt with the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Lots of American shadows that we have not dealt with, and they continue to influence us as a culture and explain to me why we are standing on a precipice right now, and it's not looking good.
Now, you collect an awesome amount of terrifying news stories, from climate change to economic collapse to terrible social developments. How do you keep hard and keep going with that kind of dark information coming at you every day?
Well, that's a really good question. This is the 10th year, by the way, that I have been producing the Daily News Digest every single day, 7 days a week, unless I'm sick or I'm traveling. This is a 2 to 3 hour project that I usually start the night before, start gathering news. And as I emphasize in my work, you cannot look at this much darkness and not have to balance it with beauty and love and all manner of things that feed your soul. I must confess, when I'm gathering the news, I'm sometimes listening to Bach or Mozart and feeling the inspiration of that music. And then, you know, at the end of my day, I just go do something that's pleasurable for me. I take a break from it. I think it's really important for us to take a break from the world situation on a daily basis. So that's what I do. So anything that we can do, not just me, any of us, to balance, you know, the darkness of what we're coping with, if we let ourselves go down these rabbit holes, we must temper that darkness with beauty and love and joy in our lives.
Okay, because despite this bad news, your latest book is Return to Joy, written with Andrew Harvey. How do we let that joy back into our lives? You've given us some hints, but is there a program or a series of tips that you offer?
Well, it comes back, in a nutshell, it comes back to what I've been saying and I continue to say, is we have to do the deep inner work. You know, in the book we talk about happiness. You know, this is a happiness-addicted culture, and happiness is very circumstantial. I'm happy if I get a promotion. I'm happy if I get a new boyfriend. I'm happy if I take a trip, you know, and on and on and on. We're a very happiness-addicted culture, and happiness doesn't last very long, so we have to keep trying to make ourselves happy. Joy is a different thing. Joy lives at our core. And we argue in the book that it's the ultimate nature of our existence. But in order to get that joy that is in our core, we have to do some work. We have to do some shadow work. We have to embrace our feelings, especially those dark emotions that we don't want to deal with, like fear, anger, grief, and despair. We have to make a commitment to this inner work in order to experience joy. And there are many people, and we talk about some in the book, who have had very difficult lives, who suffered a great deal, who faced a lot of hardship, who radiate joy, but they've been able to hold this darkness alongside the light.
What will be your next book?
Well, Andrew and I, he's going to be here this weekend. We're going to be doing some hunkering down and writing, and we're calling our next book Living Resiliently in the Dark Night of the Globe. We're going to be talking about resisting the modern face of fascism in the age of Trump, living resiliently amid global psychosis, and how do we reconnect with self, other, and earth. And the four big points of our book are the reconnection that I just mentioned, resistance against the status quo, resilience, and regeneration. And regeneration is about leaving some sort of legacy for whatever or whoever might survive us for however long or whatever time that might be after we are gone.
Is there anything that I've missed?
One thing I would like to add, for people who are looking for a regular place that is safe, where they can talk about their feelings, their thoughts, and get support and give support around collapse and abrupt climate change, we have a twice-monthly Safe Circle call online that is free, And you can become part of that mailing list and learn more about it by simply emailing me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net.
We've been talking with Carolyn Baker. She's the author and co-author of 11 books, with the 12th on the way, as you've heard. And you could look for her newest book coming out soon, Living Resiliently in the Dark Night of the Globe. You find all her podcasts and services at carolynbaker.net. And I'll put some links to what we've been talking about in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Carolyn, thank you for talking with us. And thank you for looking for the light without shying away from the darkness, as so many people do.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alex, for having me back on.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. On the Pacifica Radio Network, Francesca Rhiannon produces the series Writer's Voice. She hit the Trump climate pullout dead on with this interview.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As this episode of Writer's Voice is being produced, the news has broken that Trump intends to pull the U.S. out of the historic Paris Climate Agreement. Let's not mince words here. We're in a climate emergency. The Paris Agreement didn't go far enough, but it was a start. Trump's move is full speed back in the wrong direction. With that in mind, let's listen back to my 2014 interview with Naomi Oreskes about the book she co-authored with Eric Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. It's a science-based speculative novel about the consequences of our current inaction on the climate. I interviewed her just before the historic People's Climate March that took place in New York City and around the world in September 2014. Oreskes and Conway last collaborated on their celebrated book, Merchants of Doubt. Well, Naomi Oreskes, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, give us a setting. A historian from China is looking back from the future, writing a treatise on how and why the world failed to avert climate catastrophe. First, paint for us a portrait of her world, who she is, and how her world got that way.
Well, she is writing from the year 2393, and she lives in the Second People's Republic of China. And she's a historian, and she's been tasked with the project of trying to understand what happened to Western civilization. And the specific question that she's trying to answer is, how was it possible that those people knew so much about what was happening to them, had such detailed scientific evidence, very accurate climate models, really foresaw, correctly predicted what was going to happen, and yet took so little effective action to prevent it? So that's the question. We don't know that many details about the world in which she lives, but one of the things we do know, and it's sort of the central premise of the book, is that the liberal democracies failed to act effectively to respond to the threat when things started to break down, and so authoritarian governments stepped up to the plate, stepped into the fray, and so we have a resurgence of authoritarian government, a renewal of China, that we call that the Second People's Republic, and so she is writing from the position of an authoritarian, a renewed authoritarianism in a future Chinese state.
This idea of the centralized state versus the centralized authoritarian state versus a so-called liberal democracy is kind of at the heart of your book. Tell us, what is the problem with so-called liberal democracy? And tell us, what is the nature of that democracy that has so hampered us in being able to deal with climate change?
Well, the point of the book wasn't really so much to say that there's a problem with democracy, although I suppose that's a legitimate reading of it. It was more a kind of, meant to be a sort of cautionary tale, and it arose out of the work that Eric Conway and I did on Merchants of Doubt. One of the central realizations we made in that book, we were trying to understand why would people deny the reality of climate change, and especially why would educated, intelligent people deny it, and really especially why would scientists deny it, because the crux of that book was to look at the role of a small handful of scientists, a small handful of contrarian outlier scientists who made common cause with the fossil fuel industry and also the tobacco industry to deny scientific evidence related not just to climate change, but also to tobacco smoking and other things. And what we realized reading their work, reading their correspondence, was that they thought they were protecting freedom. They were afraid that climate change would be used as an excuse, a kind of lever to a sort of backdoor to socialism, a slippery slope to socialism. And so they opposed action on climate change, and they denied its reality because they were afraid of its implications, afraid that the response to climate change would be the growth of big government, more government intrusion in our lives, less personal liberty. And when Eric and I were reading these materials, we thought, well, this is so ironic, because by delaying action on climate change, they're actually increasing the likelihood of the very things that they don't want, that is to say, intrusive government. And so in the new book, we pick up on that premise, and we imagine, well, what happens if we fail to act on climate change? What happens if catastrophic droughts, like what's going on in California right now, begin to become more common? What happens if devastating storms like Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina start to become more common? And the obvious answer is the government calls out the National Guard. The government declares martial law if there are food riots and food shortages. Natural disasters and catastrophes almost inevitably lead to loss of personal liberty. They almost inevitably lead to governments having to take on more responsibility to evacuate people, to deny people the right to go back to those places in some cases if the problem becomes truly severe, to commandeer resources, to take over businesses. All of these things are actually likely outcomes of catastrophic climate change. And so the point of the book is to say, if you care about democracy, if you care about personal liberty, you ought to be on the front lines of demanding action on climate change. Because if we don't act and we allow things to spin out of control, it's not going to be good for personal freedom. It's not going to be good for liberty.
But there's another player here which has a very important role to play in terms of weighing on the kind of democracy or liberty we have, and that is market fundamentalism, which is the other twin force here. And you coin a wonderful term, in fact, I think one that really needs to go into the lexicon, and that is the carbon combustion complex. And in Merchants of Doubt, it was the tobacco complex. Here's the
tobacco combustion complex. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, yes, thanks for pointing that out. And we obviously thought a lot about that. So, you know, the word capitalism is a very coarse word because there are many, many different ways in which capitalism can play out. And the reality is no world, no country in the world has a purely free market system. We all have economies that are mixed in some ways, some mixture of government intervention, government regulation, government control, and free market forces. And different countries have different mixes. One of the problems we face here in the United States today, but it's not only here, it's really everywhere, but it's worse in the United States, is that we have this incredibly powerful carbon combustion complex led by the fossil fuel industry, but it's not just the fossil fuel industry. And I actually think that's really important, because if it were only the fossil fuel industry, it would be sort of easy for us to say, well, look at these terrible people. Look at what they're doing. They're putting the whole future, the future health, well-being, and prosperity of men and women and children, you know, they're sacrificing that just so that they can, what, drill a little bit more oil and gas? I mean, it's really absolutely unconscionable. So why don't we say that? And why don't we say it's obvious that we need to divest from these corporations, that we need to revoke their social license, we need to make what they're doing unacceptable? Well, because it isn't just ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell and BP, although they're obviously very important players, but it's also all the other different industries, which is essentially practically everything, that depends on inexpensive fossil fuels. It's plastics and it's transportation, it's aircraft, it's home heating, it's home construction. There really isn't a thing you can name that doesn't use energy. And in the United States, the vast, vast bulk of our energy comes from cheap fossil fuels. So to face that is to face the entire economic basis of the American way of life. And that's a very, very threatening thing. And I think that's a kind of thread that people are afraid to pull, because they're afraid that if they do pull it, the whole fabric could unravel.
That's a very dark view. Do you see no way in which those very industries can become dependent on renewables?
Well, I actually, of course, do. Otherwise, if I thought it was completely hopeless, I'd be a hermit living in the backwoods of New Hampshire. But I wouldn't be talking to you on the phone. So obviously, as I said, this is a cautionary tale. The whole point of writing is to say, it doesn't have to be this way. And so Eric and I are now working on the outline for a kind of anti-collapse, we're calling it, to think about, can we now write the alternative parallel that lays out a picture of what the alternative looks like? And the short answer to that is to say that there's a lot of talk about technological solutions, and people get reactive in both directions, both pro and con. But the reality is that we have the technology we need. We don't need to sit around waiting for some future Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla to invent some whole new form of energy. What we need is we need to change the incentives to make those forms of energy economic. And that means starting with cutting out all of the amazing, incredible subsidies to fossil fuels, but it also means breaking the power of the fossil fuel industry, and that's a really, really difficult thing. And that's one of the reasons I became involved in the divestment movement at Harvard, because I think we do need to break the power of the fossil fuel industry, and we do need to revoke their social license. And how do we do that? That's a really tough question. Well, one thing we can do is to have conversations like this, and another thing we can do is to say that we won't invest in the continued development of fossil fuels that we know are leading us on the track to collapse.
Yeah, exactly. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Naomi Oreskes about her book, which she co-authored with Eric M. Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. So another fascinating discussion in the book, coming from this historian from the Second People's Republic of China in the year 2323, is what role you could say the culture of science in the Western world, or even in the world today, has played in preventing us to deal head-on with climate change. And we want to say here, it's not as if the scientists who are putting this forward, I mean, they're heroes. James Hansen is one of my great heroes. But
yes.
you do say there's trouble in the scientific world.
Yes. And this is a very interesting point, and as you suggested, it's delicate because people like Jim Hansen and Steve Schneider, Ben Santer, Mike Mann, these guys are heroes. They've done incredibly great work, and they've paid a personal price for it, and they've been attacked, you know, completely viciously and unscrupulously. So this is not a criticism of any individual scientist, but it is to raise a question about how the scientific community as a whole speaks and communicates about science and thinks about science and thinks about the problem of proof. So one of the things that I became interested in was the question of whether or not scientists had exaggerated the threat of climate change. And as you know, many contrarians, many members of the carbon combustion complex accuse scientists of exaggerating the threat. And this, it turns out, is a very sticky accusation. And I've found when I give public lectures that many people think that this is true. And they think it's true because they think that by exaggerating the threat, scientists get more money for their research. And I thought that was an interesting argument because it could be true, right? By saying that this is a really, really serious problem, scientists could actually get more money for their research. So it's plausible that they might exaggerate the threat. So I decided to test that hypothesis. And I did a study with my postdoc, Kanan Bryce, and a couple of other colleagues, in which we actually looked at a set of climate predictions that had been made 10, 15, 20 years ago, and then compared it to what had actually happened to see whether or not this claim of exaggeration was correct. And we found that it was not correct, that in fact, not only had scientists not exaggerated the threat, that in most cases they had underpredicted it. So things like temperature rise and sea level rise had actually gone at a faster pace than scientists had anticipated. So then we asked the question, well, why? And we started talking about the culture of science and how scientists think about their own behavior. And what we concluded based on interviews with scientists, we found that many, many scientists invoked the metaphor of crying wolf. And they said, we don't want to cry wolf. And it was remarkable how many scientists said that. And when we said to them, we said, well, what about why is it okay to fiddle while Rome burns, but it's not okay to cry wolf? And then they would say things like, well, if we cry wolf, we'll lose our credibility. So within the scientific community, there's this very strong idea that the way scientists remain credible is to do everything possible not to cry wolf. That is to say, the worst possible thing you could do would be to exaggerate. And where does that come from? Well, we developed this hypothesis we call erring on the side of least drama. And what we argue is that the culture of the scientific community is committed to the idea of rationality. And there's a very, very, very deep idea in Western culture that rationality stands in opposition to emotion. We actually know that it's false. There's a lot of good evidence from neuroscience. It's just not even true. But even though it's not true, people believe it, and scientists believe it. So they think that to be scientific, they have to be unemotional. They have to be undramatic, because drama evokes emotion, and emotion, they think, undermines your ability to be rational. And so the argument we made is that the scientific community's commitment to this has actually caused them to underestimate the threat. And we see it played out specifically in the way they deal with things statistically, which is this idea of the 95% confidence limit. The 95% confidence limit says that I don't tell you I believe something unless I'm sure that there's only less than a 1 in 20 chance that that thing could have happened by coincidence. So it's setting this extremely high bar on what it takes to say that, yes, we know that something is true. And that extremely high bar contributes to a kind of scientific reticence. Jim Hansen has called it reticence, a kind of reluctance to stand up and say, yes, we know that this is true. Yes, we know that this is happening. Yes, we know that this is going to be bad, right? Because bad is a value judgment word. So scientists are very afraid to say climate change is bad. And you'll notice that if you interview them, they'll talk about meters of sea level rise, and they'll talk about temperatures above, you know, temperatures degrees C, and they'll talk about parts per million and parts per billion of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and they'll go on and on and about all kinds of very specific detail. But you'll almost never hear them simply say, and the reason why all this matters is because climate change is really bad, because climate change will hurt people. People will be injured. People will die. And so that, we have come to the conclusion, is really a big problem. So it's not climate scientists' fault that we're in the place we are, but the way they act, the cultural norms of the community, have contributed, we think, to the fact that we haven't taken more dramatic steps to deal with this problem.
Well, that's very interesting. It puts one in mind of the journalism profession, which also was extremely slow to take up the real issue, the real danger and risk of climate change, because it was afraid of being seen as non-objective.
Exactly. There is an interesting parallel, and I get asked about this by journalists a lot, and of course, usually my answer is, well, maybe you should answer that question. You know, it's a little weird for me to be telling journalists, you know, what they've done wrong. But I think that we see this very clearly. And we see it especially in this journalistic ideal of balance. The journalists think that to be balanced is to give equal side, you know, equal time to two sides of an argument. But what Eric Conway and I have always argued is, if you know that one side of that argument is untrue, if you know it's false, if you know that it has been refuted by scientific data, if you know that the questions people are raising have actually been answered, then to give equal time to those claims is actually to present a very incorrect, a very inaccurate view of the reality. So what I usually say to journalists when they ask about it is that journalists should be striving for accuracy. They should not be striving for balance, because in this case, balance turns out to be false equivalence.
Absolutely. You know, but it's so interesting that the kind of inertia that these scientific and journalistic conventions create is always in the service of those who rule, of the carbon combustion complex.
Well, that's right. And it's interesting to stop and think about that. And I think that's great that you raised that, because it would be really, really good if scientists and journalists would actually step back and just think about that point for a minute. Because I'm sure that most journalists would say that they're not intending to aid the carbon combustion complex, that they simply want to be good journalists doing a good job and giving people good information. But the fact is that the journalist world has given the American people very, very bad information over the last 20 years. And it's not just Fox News. Max Boykoff in Colorado has done some wonderful work on this. It's the mainstream media, it's the so-called liberal media, it's the so-called prestige press. We see this problem across the board in journalism, and it has nothing to do, you know, with who the editors of the newspapers and magazines are.
You also skewer some other ideas. Natural gas, the idea of natural gas as a bridge to renewables.
you know, we've talked about this on our show here. We've interviewed Richard Heinberg, who's written about that. But if you'd just like to maybe quickly sum up why natural gas is not, in fact, a bridge to renewables.
There's a couple of reasons, but the short answer is, first of all, gas is gas. It's a fossil fuel. And when you burn gas, you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In the fullness of time, there's no way to solve the problem of fossil fuels by burning more fossil fuels. That just simply cannot happen physically. So the question then becomes, why would anyone even think that gas could be beneficial? And the answer is because although it's a fossil fuel, it's not as bad as coal. So if you could replace coal with natural gas, then you could reduce your greenhouse gas production, you know, somewhat. And so many people have made the argument that this is a good first step. That argument would be a good one, in my opinion, if the transition to gas were part of a large-scale energy plan where you had a plan for how you were going to use gas as a transition fuel and how you're going to make sure that within the next 20 or 30 years we convert not just to gas, but in fact to zero carbon or extremely low carbon fuels. We don't have that plan, and no one in the world has that plan. So instead, what we're actually seeing is that natural gas is coming on board, and in many places in the world, it's not replacing coal at all. It's just becoming more fossil fuels to burn. So you're not getting a net benefit in many cases. And then the third reason, I think, is maybe the most important one is all, well, there's actually four reasons. It's a really complicated issue, and that's why I think a lot of people are confused about it. So I'll give you two more reasons. Third reason is leakage, and there's been a lot written about this. Gas wells leak. And when they leak, the natural gas, which is methane, goes directly to the atmosphere without being burnt. And methane is a much worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. If enough methane leaks out of the well and goes to the atmosphere, then any benefit you have relative to coal is completely lost. In fact, it's possible under some conditions that the gas is actually worse than coal. And we have evidence that there are significant numbers of wells in the United States and elsewhere where the leakage rates are so bad that, in fact, it is probably no benefit relative to coal and possibly even worse. So the whole story about gas being better than coal starts to look kind of questionable. It might be better than coal in terms of other benefits, like air pollution benefits, the benefits of not destroying mountaintops. But in terms of greenhouse gases, the benefit is small to negligible. And one final thing, and I think this is the most important thing of all, it has to do with structural issues. When you burn gas, you don't just burn gas. You build wells, you build pipelines, you build houses that are designed to work on natural gas, you build all kinds of infrastructure, export terminals, tankers, you know, pipelines. And that infrastructure isn't built just to last for 10 or 15 or 20 years. It's built to last for 30 or 50 or 100 years. So now we're locking into our infrastructure, into our energy system, a commitment to gas that goes way past the period in which we need to make the bridge to renewables. We need to make this change in our economy in the next 20 to 30 years. All of the scientific evidence says that. We're building infrastructure that commits us to gas for 30, 50, 100 years. So there's a gigantic disconnect between what we need to do and the arguments that are made to justify gas.
Yeah, I believe they call those sunk costs.
Well, right, exactly. The actual money you spend is a sunk cost, so now you want to recoup it. The infrastructure you build, historians of technology call this the infrastructure trap, that once you build infrastructure, because you have invested so much money in it, you've sunk so much money into it, now you're committed to using that infrastructure, and if you want to change it, it then becomes very difficult and very expensive. It becomes financially expensive because you spent all this money, and it becomes socially and politically difficult because now you have, you know, whole armies of people. You now have a gas combustion complex that will fight to defend gas, even if it's not in the interest of the larger society.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Naomi Oreskes about her book, which she co-authored with Eric M. Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. And talking about costs, as we're talking now, there was a report, I believe yesterday or the day before, that said that not only will the transition to renewables not cost us, it will actually save us money, it will create more jobs, etc. I mean, this is not a new point, but maybe new in the way it was said. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what we're seeing already in the transition to solar and wind. I believe they're either at or very close to parity with fossil fuels.
It depends where you live, because the cost of renewables varies a lot. And, of course, one of the bad things about gas is that because we've been facing an environment with a lot of cheap gas in the last few years, the financials of renewables are not as good as they would have been had we not had all this cheap gas in front of us. But it is true that there have been great advances. The cost of solar is coming down dramatically. And like a lot of things, the more we do it, the more the costs tend to come down. I mean, mass marketing does really work, right? Henry Ford was right about that. So we do seem to be at a place, particularly in some parts of the country like California, where the uptake of solar energy is becoming really quite substantial and costs are coming down dramatically. So I think that's really important. I think that's cause for optimism. But I think it's also important for people to realize that in almost all places where that's happening, there's been some kind of government program to create incentives to do that. If you leave this to the free market on its own, it's very hard for people to justify the switch. There's a lot of upfront investment cost associated with solar, and I know it because I've just put solar on my own house, and we're going to be net neutral for electricity going forward, but it took a lot of time and it took a lot of money, and not everybody's got that upfront money available. So where we see government incentives, where we see renewable portfolio standards that require utilities to get a proportion of their energy from renewables, we see very significant changes. But in states that don't have renewable portfolio standards or other incentives, the changes are much less great.
So we are airing this just in advance of the biggest People's Climate March in history. It's going to happen in New York, and right after that there are going to be climate talks at the UN next week to talk about the road to the next talks in Paris. I wonder if you could give us some thoughts on the role of social movements in moving forward.
Well, I think one of the things we know from history is that very often leaders don't really lead, they follow. They respond to the will of the people, and that's a good thing. They should respond to the will of the people. We've had a huge leadership vacuum on this issue of climate change, and it's partly because the American people haven't demanded anything different. And the American people are up against the most powerful industry in the history of mankind. So I think it's terribly important that people do take to the streets and the phones and the internet and write letters to congressmen and all the different things that people can do, because if we create enough momentum to say to world leaders, this is not acceptable, you know, you're selling out our future, our children's future, the future of biodiversity, the future of all the amazing plants and animals that we share this planet with. And for what? You know, just for a little more oil and gas for another couple of decades? It's kind of crazy. And so I think this climate march is terrifically important. And I think we've seen this in many ways in the past in the United States. If we think about women's rights or civil rights or the abolition of slavery, the role of activism, the role of movements was hugely important in all of those. And they were partly important because they forced people in leadership positions to begin to act as the leaders that they are supposed to be.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, I'll be looking for you and people to, what is it called?
Protect Our Winters. It's a group of athletes and winter sports lovers who are calling attention to climate change as an issue for the ski industry, for people who love winter, for people who snowboard. Ski industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. 20 million Americans ski or snowboard. So we're trying to mobilize that as a group of people who haven't in the past typically been involved in environmentalism or might not even really think of themselves as political, but there's something that they care about that is climate sensitive. And so we're raising awareness of climate as an issue for fun, for something that we really love. It's not just all gloom and doom. It's also about protecting things we love.
Mm, that's great. And maple syrup goes along with that.
Maple syrup, absolutely. I would really like to see a Protect Our Maple Syrup group, so maybe we can get that going too.
Okay, well, I'll be looking for you there along with my granddaughter. We're going to be marching. And
terrific. Well, if you see me, please say hello, because I don't know what you look like.
Okay, I will. Thank
terrific.
You so much, Naomi Oreskes. Your wonderful book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and I can tell our listeners it's short and extremely pithy and fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
And that was Naomi Oreskes talking with Writer's Voice in 2014.
That was scientist and author Naomi Oreskes interviewed by Francesca Rhiannon, host of the program Writer's Voice. Find all her great programs at writersvoice.net. We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.